On this episode of China Unscripted, the Chinese Communist Party is monitoring students and professors inside China and also right here in the United States. And the consequences of crossing the party line can be the death of your career. China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganeshda.
Hey guys, what is that fragrant aroma? Why, it's today's tea from Path of Cha, our sponsors. This tea is called Honey Orchid Oolong Tea. How about that smell? It's like smelling the aroma of the Jade Emperor.
I don't think I want to smell the aroma of the Jade Emperor.
Of his palace, maybe.
Well, to each their own. But yeah, this tea is supposed to, it smells like an orchid, but tastes sweet like honey, obviously without any added sugar. So it's very appropriate for you keto folk out there. Mm. Let's have a sip.
That's nice.
It is very fragrant.
Oh, wow, that's great.
It does have like this like nice floral.
So this tea comes from Phoenix Mountain, Guangdong, China. And so obviously if a tea comes from a place called Phoenix Mountain, you know, it's got to be pretty
good. We're really
good.
Leaning on the mythology today, huh?
I know. I'm just into it. It's because we're recording in the morning for a change. But yeah, this is a wonderful aroma and a very sweet taste.
I mean, for a tea, it's not going to taste like Coke.
Coke?
Diet Coke, like Coca-Cola.
Yes, okay, if you are expecting, like, a Slurpee, it will not be that sweet.
Look, I'm just trying to set expectations for America.
That's a fair point. So anyways, if you guys want to have some of the tea we're having, which once again is called Honey Orchid Milan Xiang Dan Cong Oolong Tea, we got a special link for you to go to. Go to go.pathofcha.com/unscripted. Buy this tea, and you'll be helping out the show. Or any other tea you like, you'll still be helping out the show and giving yourself some really good tea. Joining us today is Paul Mooney, a freelance American journalist who has reported from Asia for more than 30 years. He recently contributed to a report by Scholars at Risk called Obstacles to Excellence, Academic Freedom, and China's Quest for World-Class Universities. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, over the past few decades, the Chinese Communist Party has invested heavily in higher education, especially from the days of telling students to hang their teachers for being counter-revolutionaries. And it seems like this really became a thing after the Tiananmen student protests of 1989, which led to the Tiananmen Square massacre. It seemed the party realized that maybe they should take more of an interest in higher education. Why is that?
I think you know, the Tiananmen incident showed the Communist Party, you know, how dangerous a student movement can be, and you know this is how communism got started. You know, it was a small group of people, and so they saw the danger in this kind of movement, and so after the 1989 incident, they began to crack down a bit more. So they've had a tight hold on higher education and education in general since then.
That was really kind of the start of patriotic education, right?
Right.
Can you describe for the audience what patriotic education is?
Just education to, you know, about kind of, I guess, a communist way of controlling education for the purpose of the party, you know, training, educating people to be good little communists and to work for the party and to stay in line.
So I think one thing people don't really understand is that censorship in China isn't cut and dry. It's not like the party has hard and fast rules of what is allowed and what isn't allowed. It often encourages people to self-censor. What's kind of the motives behind that?
Right. Yeah. It's very vague and it's purposely vague. And as one scholar explained to me years ago, is that, you know, there's a line that you can't cross, but nobody knows where the line is. So people walk up to the line, they nudge it, they might put their foot over it, but they have to guess themselves where the line is, and because they don't know where the line is, they pull themselves back a little bit, and so this does the party's work. So the party doesn't have to censor people because people censor themselves. They're not sure where the lines are, and so they kind of try to guess where it is and then pull a bit short of that.
How often does the line move?
I don't know because, you know, the line, nobody ever knew where it was. But it works perfectly because everyone, and this goes for the media as well as for academia, everyone has to kind of guess where it is. And you're looking at what happened to this person, what happened to that person, why did they get into trouble? And so everyone's doing a mental calculation, you know, of where the line is. And so it's just safer. Some people refer to it as a circle, to pull that circle in closer to oneself to make sure you don't go too far.
So it's pretty safe to do a new report on Xi Jinping thought and be pretty confident that you're not going to get in trouble for that.
Exactly right. And in recent years, or since Xi Jinping thought was promoted, there's been a large amount of academic research done on Xi Jinping thought, because everyone knows it's a sure thing, and a lot of time is being wasted writing about something that doesn't have that much intellectual basis to it.
So this must be an incredibly hard environment for both Chinese scholars and for visiting foreign scholars in the country.
Yes, in different ways. Foreign scholars also have to be quite careful. They don't want to lose their ability to get a visa. They don't have their research cut short. But it's already quite difficult for foreign scholars to do research, and a lot of them have stopped going to China to do research. Scholars I've spoken to said they're relying more on archive material that they can access from anywhere in the world. So if it's something historical or something, that if you don't have to be there, then you can just sit back in New York or San Francisco and you do your research, because it's too difficult to go there and get permission. And there are a lot of stories of people having problem getting the information what they want. So it's really kind of hamstrung a lot of scholars. And for Chinese scholars, it's worse, because they're right there in the scene and they have to worry a lot more about what they do. Foreign scholar, well, he won't get a visa or he'll be kicked out. But for a Chinese scholar, you know, it means your career could end, or you could end up even being arrested.
Are you familiar with the case of the Japanese scholar who was arrested in China and accused of being a spy?
I've read about it. I don't know the details. I did read about it, but I don't know a lot of the background.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because one of the reports said that what he'd actually gotten in trouble for was buying KMT-era documents in like a secondhand bookshop.
Yeah, it's absurd. So, you know, there are a lot of cases like this where you do something that would be considered normal behavior in any other country, but in China they turn it around and you end up becoming charged as being a spy or something like that. So it's quite common for the communist regime to do that type of thing.
Well, I know the Communist Party has used this as a way to sort of spread party propaganda overseas. I remember, like, 20 years ago, a lot of the academic research done by foreign scholars who were working in China, for example, they would have to, the only information they were getting about something like Falun Gong, for instance, was state-run propaganda. And so you would see this kind of thing repeated in the scholarly works of foreign scholars, that, you know, Falun Gong was a cult, the party had to crack down on it. So if the party can control academic research, doesn't that give it a pretty dangerous level of power over how the world thinks and views China?
I would hope that academics would, and I'm pretty sure that they're aware of this, and that I don't see them being kind of having the wool pulling over their eyes about something like Falun Gong or this type of thing. Yeah, the government will try to control the narrative. But I don't think reputable scholars are taken in by this. The more dangerous thing is that it discourages a lot of scholars from researching things. So, you know, I once spoke to a Chinese literature professor at Princeton University, and he told me that one of his PhD students was trying to think of a topic to research, and he suggested a popular novel that had come out a few years earlier that he thought would be good for PhD research. And the student said, "Oh, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to write about something that might get me banned from China." So because they have these rules and because the government retaliates, a lot of people things aren't being researched, because people either can't get access to the information because the government controls it, or else because they don't want to jeopardize their careers. This is quite a serious problem.
I imagine it must be hard to do research on, for example, Xinjiang right now.
Oh, I would say it's impossible. I mean, some of the top Xinjiang scholars have been writing, you know, more for, you know, I see a lot of writing for the mass media on the, I think because they're so concerned about the Xinjiang incident. So they're actually stepping up and writing a lot more, but I don't think any of them are able to, you know, it's difficult for anyone to go to Xinjiang now, especially an academic, and you're certainly not going to have contact with people. And one Xinjiang scholar told me, that she went there recently and tried to meet with, six or seven of her Uyghur sources, and not a single person would talk to her. So there's this sense of fear. And it's something that I felt as a journalist also, that many times people are afraid to speak to you because they don't want to get in trouble. They know they're being watched. And it's the same for academics. And a lot of academics don't want to get people in trouble. And one of the examples I got when I worked on the Scholars at Risk report was that people are going in. Every foreign scholar has to have a host organization when they go in to do research, another university, a professor. And you don't want to go in and write something on a sensitive issue, and then you leave and you find out that your colleague, your Chinese colleague, got into trouble, was fired, or was interrogated by the police because, oh, you're the one that assisted him. You bear responsibility. So that's another way that they control academics foreign academics in China by the threat to their sources.
Well, I think this is a good time to just kind of touch briefly on your own experiences. You were reporting from China for quite some time, and then, well, why don't you just briefly kind of talk about that story?
Sure. Yeah, I was based in China for 18 consecutive years from 1994 to 2012. I was always accredited. Every year I got my journalist accreditation renewed. Every year I was nervous, though. I thought, okay, maybe this year I won't be lucky. And when it happened, it came out of the blue. I didn't expect it. And they never gave a reason, which is part of this narrative, too. So other journalists get nervous because they don't know, well, why did Paul Mooney, why was he refused a visa? Was it because he reported on Xinjiang? Was it because he reported on politics in China? Was it what reason? So it makes all the journalists have the same feeling, is that I better be careful because I might get into trouble, you know, for reporting. And so in November 2012, in November 2013, I was offered a position in Beijing with Reuters, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said I wouldn't get a visa, and no reason was given. And it could have been some stories I'd done around the time that I, just before I left. It could have been a kind of a cumulative thing, but they never gave a reason. So again, it's a message to other journalists and to scholars alike that, we don't know what happened to him. So we better be double careful about what we write and what we say.
So how does this censorship pressure affect the kind of Western media coverage of China?
It's hard to say. I mean, I would say that my colleagues always reported on things anyway. But it does make people nervous. And I know there was one American journalist who worked for AP. She was one of the best reporters covering human rights. She had wonderful, amazing contacts with rights lawyers and activists and things. But they put so much pressure on in the end that she got quite nervous, and she stopped doing the reports that she used to do. And then her Chinese friend said, oh, you've changed. You're not doing this anymore. But she was afraid of being kicked out. I mean, you know, they harassed her. They'd call her meetings in a police station in a basement someplace. They'd threaten her. And so this has an impact on people. And when my visa was rejected, this is a good example. I got a call from a European journalist who interviewed me. And this was in November. And he said, okay, I'm going to write my story, but I won't publish it until January because I'm applying for my annual visa renewal now, and I don't want anything to happen. And so when he said this, I understood, but I started saying, well, when does November become October? When does October become September? You know, that people are nervous about getting their visas renewed and they start to self-censor.
Well, so let's bring it back to academia for a moment. What is life like for your average Chinese college student, university student?
You know, a lot of them don't have any idea what's going on. You know, they know that they, you know, that they have to be careful about what they say in class. But they're, a lot of them are unaware that, you know, their professors are having to you know, watch what they say in class. You know, there's an extensive system of cameras in the classrooms. There are students that are work for the Communist Party to report on what professors say. But a lot of this, I spoke to one Chinese student about it, and she said she didn't think her classmates were aware of the spying that was going on, the recording of information, you know, that a lot of didn't. But she also said, but we've become so used to it that we just take it for granted.
Yeah, I think we actually need to focus on some things you said there, because like what you just said is horrifying. There are cameras in the classrooms making sure students, like recording what students say. And there is an active system of spying on teachers and students. Like, that is horrendous in a university.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah. And, you know, when there's a well-known Uyghur scholar, Ilham Todi, who was given life in prison in 2014. And I spoke to, he had invited a well-known Chinese rights lawyer to speak in his class. And later, video of that talk that he gave, that this Chinese scholar gave, was used in the trial against Ilham Todi, where he was sentenced to life.
Wow.
Although the Chinese lawyer didn't say anything, you know, that he wouldn't have said in his own class, but they used that video and audio to as part of the evidence. And actually, the Chinese professor told me that he didn't notice any cameras in the room, so it could have been reported with it. Could have been recorded with it with a mobile phone. You know, we don't know. But there are classes where you can actually see the cameras in the classroom. So, you know, it's 1984.
Has this been something that's been going on for a while, or do you think it's been ramped up in recent years?
The surveillance camera is something that's been ramped up in recent years. Prior to that, it was more a case of, you know, there were always students in the class that were reporting on what the teachers say. And it's the same actually in the U.S. There are Chinese students at places even like Harvard or Yale that are writing reports on what Chinese professors or foreign professors say in the class. You know, so it's even happening in other countries.
And where do these reports go?
Oh, back to public security in China.
That's crazy. They're being spied on in the U.S.
Yes, yes. Both foreign and Chinese.
And I understand that groups like the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, often they're behind a lot of this spying and censorship, right?
It's believed that they're behind it. It's hard to find evidence. Hmm. I spent about a year trying to get information on the Students and Scholars Association, but couldn't come up with anything concrete. I think In those organizations, a lot of the Chinese students belong to it because they have a party at Chinese New Year and make dumplings, or they pick you up at the airport when you arrive. It's only a very small handful that are involved in the politics of the organization, and I found that it's very tough to crack that core. So it's, you find people say, "Oh yeah, I was a member, but I don't remember anything this or that," you know. But it did, you know, and there was a case recently in Canada where a Tibetan student was criticized, and also where a Uyghur student in two different universities, and in both cases the Chinese Students and Scholars Association were involved and actually reported to the consulates in Canada to say, this person speaking, here's what they're planning to do. So they're actually coordinated with the Chinese consulates in Canada.
So the real question is, are Tibetans and Uyghurs part of the Chinese Students and Scholars Association? Or are they forbidden, or are they required to join?
I don't. No one's required to join. It's all up to the individual. No one's required. I don't think any most Tibetan or Uyghur students would not want to join unless they're Tibetan or Uyghur students that come from a family that has party ties. That happens too. But I've never heard of any Tibetan or Uyghur students being part of the organization. But I don't see why not if they wanted to join. But it's not required, and I would imagine that the vast majority want nothing to do with the organization.
Do you think that this is an issue that, you know, universities outside China are taking seriously?
Increasingly, but not until recently. You know, I have a Chinese friend who's an academic. She's from China. She had students going back and reporting on her back. And then Or someone that would come back and say, oh, when I went home, the Public Security Bureau people interrogated me and they asked about you and they told me A, B, and C about you. Well, my friend was shocked. How did they know about this? You know, about things about her personal life, you know? And she said was quite taken aback by it. And so there were students in her class that were going back during the break and were being called in and told to testify, or not to testify, but they were asked questions. I know another Chinese student, this is going back a few years, who went back after graduating from American University. When she got there, her father was at the airport and the police were at the airport. And she was detained overnight and was interrogated for about 8 or 9 hours. And they pulled out a stack of papers, you know, probably 9 or 10 inches thick. It was tweets she had made and all sorts of comments she made on social media. Whoa. And she told me that what shocked her was that she never used her real name and she never used her own computer. She would use like a public computer in the library. But she did have a handle. And so, and again, this is why people are nervous. We can only assume that there was a student who was friends with her, knew her handle and her real identity, who was also, you know, working for the government and told them, okay, this is her name. She's the one that's doing it. So she was confronted at the airport with a huge stack of comments she had made on social media, completely, you know, so you can see how serious it was.
That's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Was she okay?
She's okay, but she doesn't go back anymore. And the other thing too is that, you know, both her and several of my Chinese academic friends, they stopped calling home. They don't even go home. They're afraid to go home, but they stop going home because, you know, if they call home, then the police will make regular visits to the homes of Chinese academics and students who are abroad that the government sees as some sort of enemy, you know. And so this one friend of mine said, and it's in the report, she said, you have to have a cold heart to do this kind of work because you have to give up everyone you love.
Wow.
That does seem to be a stark choice.
Yeah, and so she just stopped calling home. Didn't want to get her parents into trouble. So if they didn't know anything, then they couldn't be pressured to say anything.
So it seems like the idea that, you know, Chinese students can study abroad and then be exposed to liberal democracy, it's not really working out like that.
Well, I think they can be exposed to liberal democracy. It's just that in class, I think they have to worry about what they're saying, what they're doing. You know, I was told by one academic that one of the Chinese students said, I want to take your class, but I don't want to be in any class photos. I don't want to be in anything that's on social media. I don't want anything to be available for anybody to see that I'm taking this class.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. How aware are the Chinese students themselves of the level of monitoring?
I don't know how aware they are, but I do believe that they're all aware. Yeah, I mean, they're afraid. They watch what they say and what they do, and they don't take certain courses. You know, they won't go to certain lectures or campus talks because they don't know who's going to be there, you know, kind of making a list of who's there, who's spoken.
This is very Stasi sounding.
Yeah. Well, so one thing I'm wondering about is more and more you're hearing cases of, like, Chinese students abroad being virulently pro-CCP, especially dealing with anything tied to the Hong Kong protests. Is how much of this is genuine patriotic feeling and how much of it is just this buildup of knowing, I don't know who's spying on me, I don't know what this is going to do to my parents?
Yeah, I think that in terms of maybe expressing independent views, maybe supporting the Hong Kong protests, that they're afraid to say anything because it could affect their parents, could affect them. Maybe they'll never be able to go back home again. In terms of their support, I believe it's genuine. You know,
really?
They've been raised in that system. They've only had propaganda. And so that's what they believe. They don't know any better. And so, you know, when a Chinese professor who was a student in 1989 teaches a course on the 1989 crackdown, some of the mainland students are outraged. And it's because they truly have not heard about this before. You know, they're not aware of it, and it's got to be a lie.
Are they? They're outraged that the professor is talking about the Tiananmen Square,
yes.
Not that it happened, but that they're talking about it.
No, well, they're outraged because they believe it never happened.
So they think the professor's just slandering China.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, they'll go online. They'll go to the this is one of the kind of complicated things. They'll go to the administration of the university and say, you know, Professor so and so is telling lies in the class. And in one case, the administration called the professor in and said, oh, can't you try to see things more from their point of view? Mm-hmm. Well, there is no, you know, it's not their point of view. It's history. You know, it's not something that there's two sides to, you know. And, you know, so this is, you know, so some of these younger professors especially are, you know, kind of have a tough time because they don't get, you know, especially if it's at a small, a lot of colleges are becoming increasingly dependent on Chinese students because they pay cash, you know, tuition, they pay it. And so the schools need more, you know, people are paying the entire tuition up front, you know, so they try to kind of, you know, massage the feelings of the Chinese students.
Speaking of that, I know somebody who is at, I think it's Ohio State University, and like they're complaining that there's not enough seats in the university for local Ohio kids because so many Chinese students are coming and paying cash that they're getting the seats.
Right, right. Yeah, and so it's especially for smaller colleges or colleges that are having, you know, trouble kind of, you know, with money, then the Chinese students are, you know, a ready source of income, you know, and like the case with the Uyghur student, I forget her name, in Canada, this was just 6-7 months ago, she gave a talk on the situation in Xinjiang, and the Chinese Students and Scholars Association tried to have the talk canceled, organized, to have the university cancel, saying that she was spreading, you know, spreading lies and it wasn't true. And, you know, some of it might be propaganda, but I think the bulk of it is that they don't know about these things. It's never, come up in their education before. Anytime somebody attacks the government, they take it very personal. They're proud to be Chinese. I understand that. But they have a trouble kind of differentiating between, you know, the Communist Party and China as a country sometimes.
I think when the Dalai Lama was about to speak at, like, UC San Diego, that was kind of one of the biggest reactions in recent years, where the Chinese students really came out and protested that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Chinese students said their feelings were hurt. Here's our graduation. You know, we've been studying for 4 years. We spent a lot of money for this education, and you're insulting us by having the Dalai Lama speak here. And to the university's credit, they allowed the speech to go on, but China canceled academic exchanges with the university after that. And I don't know how long it lasted, but Chinese scholars who wanted to come and do exchange programs and do research at San Diego, if they were trying to come on official programs, they couldn't do it. The Chinese government basically blocked the University of San Diego. It might have been brief, 6 months, a year, I don't know, but they did it. And so universities are nervous. What's going to happen?
Yeah, that also means that they basically blocked the university from getting a huge amount of money from those students.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they could, you know, I don't know if it had any impact on the number of students that wanted to study, you know, that, it, you know, but certainly what the government could control, you know, and the government could say, we're sending people to, they would lose money there. Yeah. If they're sending, you know, people for post PhD research or things like that, then they're not going to make that money. That exchange is gone now, you know. And so this is always the case. Every time there's this fear that, well, one, they won't let students come here to study, or two, they'll cancel programs, you know, that they have with us, that type of thing. So there's always a fear of challenging China on these sensitive political issues.
So what can Western universities do?
All they can do is to stand up. Universities have to, you know, have to operate on the basis of what the truth is, and also in kind of fair, you know, freedom of speech and these types of things. And you can't allow decisions to be made for political reasons, you know. So occasionally you hear that a conference was canceled here or there, or a program was canceled. And the conventional wisdom is it was done for political reasons or that China leaned on them, but you never know. You don't get an answer. A prominent Chinese legal scholar was given a contract from the American Bar Association to write a book on the cases, the human rights cases he handled in China, an academic book. And then he was given a contract and then heard nothing. And he went back to the American Bar Association and asked them. And they said, we have programs in China to promote, rule of law. And we're afraid that if we publish this book, that China will cancel the programs. So he eventually found someone else to publish the book. But, this is what happens. And there was a case in Australia. Clive Sinclair, an Australian researcher, wrote a book talking about Chinese interference and in Australian academia.
Clive
and
Hamilton,
government.
Do you mean?
Clive Hamilton, I'm sorry, Clive Hamilton.
Yeah. Yeah, we've spoken to him. We've had
right,
him on the show.
And the publisher pulled out, and they said, we're afraid we're going to be sued. He did eventually find another publisher, but the first publisher pulled out. And what's also is we're finding more and more cases of leading academic journals, top academic journals, declining to publish an article that might upset the Chinese government.
Because they publish in China, or what's the reason for that?
Yeah, because a lot of them, a lot of them publish in China, or they publish Chinese journals for China abroad. And sometimes there's a lot of money involved because we're talking about a company that might be doing dozens and dozens and dozens of academic journals, medical journals, things like this. And the Chinese government has leaned on them saying, we don't want to see anything on this article on Xinjiang. We don't want to see that. And so there have been quite a few cases in the last two or three years where academic publishing houses have kind of bowed to China. They don't want to offend China. They don't want to lose the business that they have in China.
If this happens, like say you're trying to publish an article as an academic, like could you get into the situation where you can't find a journal that will publish you if it's too controversial?
It's quite common, and there are Chinese scholars who've been blacklisted, like Teng Biao, the prominent rights lawyer. He was basically, one of the top legal scholars in China. He was blacklisted. He couldn't get into any of the key journals. And I know other people, the only source they have is overseas journals or some of the overseas Chinese media, or sometimes media in China will be able to publish things like this. But a lot of academics that speak out are completely frozen from academic publishing. So they're forced to go to newspapers or foreign publications to get their writing published.
Gosh, this is a nightmare. I'm curious to get more of a sense of the life of like a Chinese student inside of China. So say I'm a typical Chinese student. I may or may not know about the AI facial recognition cameras that have been installed in the classroom, or that my fellow students might be spying on me. And so say I raise my hand in class one day and say, hey, I've heard something about June 4th. What's that all about? What might happen to a student like that?
I'm pretty sure that if a student did that, somebody in the university or somebody from Public Security Bureau would go to that student and would interrogate them and ask them why they had asked that question.
Wow, really?
There's no doubt in my mind that that's what would happen. And I haven't heard of any specific examples, but I know that with some academics, some scholars, that's what happens. If they say something in class that's politically incorrect from the Communist Party's point of view, they'll be threatened.
So it sounds like, though, from what you're saying, that something that could even happen overseas, though, to a Chinese student who asked about Tiananmen.
Sure. And that's why I think that, there are Chinese academics and Chinese students sitting abroad who were reluctant to make any statements or to say anything about politics because they're afraid this being reported. And so I know there was at Harvard, there was a kind of a political salon of Chinese academics. And they would meet once a week and kind of have a free discussion. And I was told by the organizer that the Chinese participants would say, who's going to be there? Give me the names. They wanted to know who each person was because they were afraid that that the person might be a spy working for the government. And so if it was an unknown person was there, then other people wouldn't want to come.
That level of paranoia, it seems justified. And also it seems like there's nothing that universities can really do to protect students or scholars.
I mean, yeah, Shelley, it's not called paranoia if they really are after you.
Yeah. The university can do things where it's where they know you have an incident like in Canada where the Chinese Students and Scholars Association stood up, or in San Diego where they tried to stop the Dalai Lama. That they can do. But things like this, it's hidden. It's invisible, and the universities don't see it. So there's nothing that anyone can do about it.
Jeez. And so what about like persecuted groups inside China? Say like there's a student who's like, oh, my parents practice Falun Gong. It doesn't seem like what you, the teacher, is telling me about that is quite jiving with reality. What happens in a situation like that?
Well, there's been a couple of incidents that were quite scary. One was at Duke University, and it's probably going back to around 2012 when there were protests in Lhasa, in Tibet. So a lot of protests broke out, and there was one Chinese female student at Duke University who tried to be in it. There were clashes between the Tibetan students and the Han Chinese students. And this one Chinese student tried to be a mediator and try to calm things down. And she ended up having to go into hiding. They actually found her. They have the human search engines.
Oh, the human flesh search.
Human flesh search engines went into action. They found her parents' address. Her parents were threatened. Trash was thrown on the door of her house, of her family's house. Her parents were afraid. She ended up staying in the U.S. She was afraid to go back home again. Okay. Then more recently, and I believe it was a year or two ago, there was a Chinese student who was the class valedictorian at the University of Maryland, and she stood up and she said that there were a lot of things and freedoms in America that she appreciated they didn't have in China. It immediately went viral, and she was under attack, and she issued an apology a few days later. Oh, I'm sorry, I said the wrong thing, I offended. So here's this bright student who's not done anything wrong. She's told with something that she feels to do, and she was so frightened. And again, they tracked down, here's your address, here's your mother and father, here's where they work, so it's quite scary for Chinese students and academics.
So what is it that is making, like, the people of China, like, attack these people so virulently, like, just tooth and nail?
I think it's because, the Chinese government for decades has attacked the West, and particularly America, saying, oh, America or the West is trying to undermine China. It's trying to stop China from becoming a developed country. People grow up with a kind of an anger about this. They believe it. It's they hear it every day. It's in the newspapers. It's said. And so when they go to America and somebody starts wants to give a talk on the detention camps in Xinjiang, and they don't believe it's true, it's, oh, this is more kind of Western propaganda. And especially if it's a case of Xinjiang and the Uyghurs, they're convinced that the Uyghurs are terrorists, that it's a very dangerous, and that what the government's doing is correct.
Jeez.
So
I'm guessing since the Hong Kong police have laid siege to several Hong Kong universities, things in Hong Kong are not going very well either.
Yeah, there have been mainland students who have expressed support for the Hong Kong students in social media, and they've been visited by the police and threatened. I haven't kind of looked into it very closely, but I've heard of several cases where mainland students, and I was surprised that they actually took the side of the Hong Kong students and protesters, but they did it, and quickly the police were able to find out where they were and who they are. And so people, are also afraid to kind of say anything like that, show their support.
So what about the situation for students from the West who are studying in China?
It's also a problem. Now, most of the Western students that go to China to study, a lot of them are in language programs. There are some that are doing research. There was a German student, I think it was the year before last, who got kicked out because he was doing some research. I don't remember what the topic was. It was something sensitive, and the Chinese government kicked him out of China.
He was a journalism student. I remember
yeah, that's
this.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And, you know, and so I think, and I know that a lot of the programs, the foreign-run programs in China, when the students come at the beginning of the year, they give them a little talk and say, here's what you have to avoid. And I actually taught media studies at the Beijing Institute for Chinese Studies. It's a Jesuit consortium in Beijing 2 or 3 times. And I myself, you know, I said what I wanted to, and my, you know, but, you know, those Western programs, they're usually safer because they're the Chinese government doesn't really care what anyone says to foreign students. They're only concerned about what's said to Chinese students. But I certainly, if one of my students came to me and said, I want to do research on the Falun Gong, I would say, don't do it. It's dangerous. You're just going to get into trouble. I would have advised them not to do it, you know. So it's an easy way to get kicked out of China and out of the program. I wouldn't advise any students I had to do anything on a sensitive topic.
So what's interesting is that the overall macro effect of this is that there's a large number of topics that just don't get researched, don't get, you know, even if they are, they don't get published anywhere. And so it's kind of not so much necessarily Chinese Communist Party propaganda in academic papers. It's rather the perception of China is heavily influenced by what gets left out of the discussion.
Sure. Yeah. And it's a little bit of both, you know, because a lot of people do write propaganda because, you know, it's a way to, you know, to move forward, to advance.
Right, I guess
so you'll have people that write propaganda things. And then, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Yeah, like when you write about, you know, academic research on Xi Jinping thought on Chinese socialism. Or was it Xi Jinping thought on
socialism with Chinese
with
characteristics,
characteristics for a new era. There we go. Got it right.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, a Chinese professor told me that if you wanted to get a research grant approved and get money, just put Xi Jinping thought in the title of the report. You know, he even gave me a statistic on how many papers. So you do, number one, you have a lot more people writing propaganda. It's a waste of funds. And then what you have is a vacuum and what's not being written about, right? So there are a lot of topics that are never going to be explored in China because it would be political suicide, you know, to do it. You know, so we're missing out on a lot of necessary academic research because there's no space in China to do that kind of research. So it's a combination of propaganda and then the vacuum being there. And you know, also it's one point I should make is that, of course, the problems are much more serious for people in the liberal arts and maybe for law. If you're a biologist or a physicist or, you know, an engineer, you're not going to run into these many problems. But there are also problems areas. And if somebody wants to write something about the environment when the government's denying there's certain environmental problems, I don't think anyone could write an academic paper on aspects of the AIDS problem in China. There are a lot of issues that China is, you know, doesn't want to be discussed. And those things are, and that's bad because, you know, this kind of research would be important for China, for the environment, for public health, these kind of things, but they're banned from being, not that maybe they're banned, but people just, I'm not going to take a sensitive topic like that, you know? So I would say that, yeah, the bulk of the problem is in the liberal arts, but even the sciences suffer because there are topics that, you know, if the government has a line on something, then no one's going to get funding to do or no one's going to want to stick their neck out to do research on something that's going to contradict the party line. So it's quite a serious problem.
Well, it seems to me a side effect of all of this is it really prevents Americans from understanding the Chinese Communist Party. And you find yourself in a situation where many Americans have no idea that the Chinese Communist Party is an authoritarian state. A lot of people think it's a democracy or that there just is no problem.
Yeah. Although I think a lot of the problem there is that a lot of people just don't read much. You know, I've been shocked at what I've been in American forums where Chinese movies being shown. I'm shocked when people go, oh, I didn't realize women were oppressed in China. I thought, you know, women like held up half the sky and were like leaders and like, you know, and I think, but that's, it's ignorance, I think, because a lot of people in the West just don't. And that was what was frustrating for me. I was a reporter in China for 18 years. I wrote about China for 5 or 6 years before that from Hong Kong, and or 10 years before that from Hong Kong and Taiwan. And then I would feel like, I'd meet, you know, educated people who didn't know that there were prison camps in Xinjiang, or didn't know that, you know, that there were that Tibetan monasteries were had cameras in the front of them, and that monks were tortured or beaten, you know, or that there was this issue or that issue. But I think a lot of that. But yeah, sure, there's a problem when a lot of information is available. But there's enough information out there that people should at least have. People should know it's not a democracy, you know, at the very least. They don't, you know.
They should.
Yeah. Yeah.
But often I am faced with the fact that many people don't have any idea.
Right. Yeah. 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 I was always disappointed by that because I thought I spent 30 years of my life writing about these topics, and then, you know, could you know, person after person that I would chat with and say, what'd you write about? And I'd say, oh, this. And, oh, I had no idea it was that bad.
Well, you know, that makes me feel a little better because often I feel like, hey, I've been making this show for 7 years, right, and people still aren't paying attention. But, I mean, you've done 30 years of it, so. Right.
Is there anything that can be done about some of these problems that you've talked about today?
Yeah, I think that universities around the world that have partnership with Chinese universities, I think they should put pressure on China. You know, Ilham Todi, a well-respected economist, not political in any way, you know, never got involved in any kind of political activities in China, and he got life in prison. You know, any university that's dealing with his university, they should put pressure. And I think if Beijing University found out that Harvard wasn't going to have an exchange program because of professors had been fired for expressing their opinions, or for, and then I think that you'd see that it would attract world notice, international attention, and then the universities would be hard pressed. I really would like to see international academia, universities, saying, not retaliate, but say, express what's wrong and say, you know, we don't like this is wrong, and try to put pressure on the universities, make the universities feel pressure. Of course, it's the government that's doing this, but in a lot of cases, the universities are proactive. It's the same thing. They're going, well, we don't exactly know if this person's going too far, but we better be careful. So we're gonna, you know, fire him, you know, and you know, there's a professor that I mentioned in the report, Michael, his name is Chao Mu, and you know, he was a journalism professor, quite popular in China, and I guess he took part in some activities that the government didn't like, and he was eventually lost his job, and I think they sent him to work in the library, and they had him doing translating, and he lost, and you know, now a lot of professors survive on funding they get for doing academic research. It's sometimes a huge amount of money. Could be 3-4 times what their salary is. And so he was completely cut off from doing academic work, from having any contact with students, from getting any funding. So he eventually just gave up and moved to the U.S. You know, and there are countless other academics that are like this in the same situation. They've been put in the position where they can't do anything. So a lot of times they don't necessarily get fired, but they're pushed, you know, into some very kind of, you know, menial positions where eventually they just leave on their own.
Well, gosh, thanks for joining us today, Paul, and talking about all these things.
Sure.
You know, I often find that, you know, we've been doing the show for like 7 years now, and I think I speak for everyone when I say, like, I feel like I really have a good idea of what's happening in China, and then I talk to somebody like you, and I'm left completely terrified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. When I was approached to do the report, and when I spoke to people about the report, who weren't kind of China watchers, they were kind of shocked when I said, this is the kind of pressure that's on academia in China. They had no idea. They couldn't believe this was going on, you know. So, and I think part of the idea of the report is to generate knowledge about this. And then also to, you know, there's some guidelines at the end of the report. We're saying here's things that we can do. But certainly I think Western universities around the world should express their opinions and not remain silent about these things. You know, years ago, just one final anecdote.
Sure.
With Perry Link, he's been banned from China since around 89, I think. And there was another academic at Princeton who was banned from going to China. And the president of Princeton University went to China, didn't mention their case at all, but gave a speech and said, we've got to do something about the American government not providing enough visas to Chinese students to go to the U.S. So he didn't have the, they didn't have the courage. Princeton University, you'd think pretty independent, but didn't have the courage to stand up to China on this. You have your own scholars who are banned from going, you know, to that country. You know, then, you know, if well, I would hope that Princeton wouldn't accept an invitation to give a speech at the university then. Why are you giving them credibility by doing this? And, you know, and sometimes the treatment is pretty harsh of the people that are the targets of these types of programs. Again, it's a lot of times it's the Public Security Bureau, it's the Communist Party, but in a lot of cases it's the university being proactive.
Okay, Paul. So for anyone listening who would like to know more about you or what you do, where should they go? Where should they follow you?
Yeah, you can go to my website. It's www.pjmooney.com, and you'll find links there, I think, to my Facebook and to my Twitter and other things.
Great. And once again, the report is called Obstacles to Excellence, Academic Freedom, and China's Quest for World-Class Universities. I'll provide a link below for those of you on YouTube. And yeah, I think the takeaway for people listening, especially if you're in academia, is to, you know, just kind of become aware of what the Chinese students are facing, both in terms of ideological education and brainwashing, and also the tremendous amount of pressure they face from spying and censorship.
Right. And when you post the link, there's a translation in Chinese of the report. Post that link too, because I think it would be great if more Chinese people could read the you know, even in China, if the report got more, you know, kind of, if more people read it in China as well. So there's an English and a Chinese version of the report.
All right, I'll put both links. Although I don't know how widely shared the YouTube version will be.
Right. Okay, wait, just in case, yeah.
Well,
just in
case. I know, I have talked to somebody who listens to our podcast in his car in China.
Yeah. Apparently, I don't know if I want to say that, but apparently China Unscripted, the podcast, is not banned in China yet.
Oh, really? They don't know about it yet. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So we made it through the firewall.
That's great, yeah.
Thanks again for joining us.
All right, thank you.
This was really interesting.
It's great to talk to you all. Thank you.
Well, thanks again for listening, everyone. Remember, treat Chinese students with compassion and invite them for a cup of tea, perhaps from Path of Cha. Go to go.pathofcha.com/unscripted to buy some tea and help out the show a little bit.
I think it's better to have Chinese students have tea with you than with the Public Security Bureau.
Yes, a nice version of being invited to tea.
Yes.
All right. Well, yes, thanks again for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Chong.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
We'll talk to you next time.